You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today is from Leviticus, a book that doesn't get a lot of love. Its reputation for being dry and pedantic is due, for the most part, from its being painfully dry and pedantic. The first 25 chapters are all about the nitty-gritty details of establishing sacred rituals and the laying down of laws that, for the most part, are hopelessly mired in ancient misinformation and no longer make any sense, except the bit about not sacrificing your children to Molech. That still seems to be pretty good advice. Anyway, by the time we get to chapter 26, all that's left is a brief restatement of God's expectations, followed by a very clear statement of the consequences for non-compliance. In short, if you refrain from worshiping idols, keep the Sabbath, and follow all these other aforementioned rules, then you'll have plenty of rain, bountiful crops, and your enemies will all be defeated. If you don't, then get ready for sudden terror, wasting diseases, and defeat by your enemies. Capiche? So, of all the other rules, the only two that are restated here are the two that will set the Jews apart from every other culture and people in the region. Number one, keep the Sabbath holy. And number two, no idols, graven images, or standing stones. Not because God was worried about people getting the likeness right, but because God was trying to redirect the people's attention beyond the shallow and the superstitious. So, when you hear the word idol in our passage today, remember the Hebrew word for idol is elil, which has a literal meaning of good for nothing, like vapor or something ephemeral or fleeting. So, don't commit your whole self to something transient, no matter how seductive and normative it might seem in the moment. It seems simple, but it's not.
Our words of wisdom are from Leviticus chapter 26, verse 1. You shall make for yourselves no idols, and erect no carved images or pillars, and you shall not place figured stones in your land to worship at them. For I am the Lord your God. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Travel back with me to the middle of the book of Exodus. Moses has gone up the mountain to talk to God, but has been gone for 40 days and 40 nights, that biblical magic number. And the people are getting impatient. Where is this guy? The people are stuck in the desert and they're growing restless. They're so used to these big supernatural shows, the parting of the seas, pillars of fire. So just sitting around and waiting isn't their speed. So, with Moses and God otherwise occupied, the people get busy breaking as many of the Ten Commandments as possible, one after the other. First one's on the list, no worshiping other gods or making idols. Check. They take all their jewelry and melt it down to form the golden calf. If anyone stopped to ask them what they were doing, they said, look, we don't want some ethereal, demanding deity. Let's just have a real God that we can physically hold on to and take around with us, one that looks good and increases our status. How about a God that affirms our prejudices and doesn't demand anything of us that we're not completely comfortable with? So they produce with their own hands a God which they can see, touch, and take along with them. And not only that, but they're not above a little cultural appropriation. They choose a symbol that is remarkably similar to the fertility gods common in the region at that time. They substitute this thing, which they can grasp, which appeals to their primal feelings, for the incomprehensible mystery of the divine. Because at our core, we human beings have a longing to experience that, call it what you will, the holy, the more, wonder, awe, God. When Rudolf Otto wrote his book, The Idea of the Holy, he described the source and sense of that indescribable and awe-inspiring sacredness with the Latin words numen and numinous, words that suggest the presence of divinity that is just beyond our ability to grasp or describe. And because it's so hard to articulate and harder still to just conjure up at a moment's notice, we human beings have tended to respond to that longing with paying homage to objects or experiences of our own making. As a species, we have evolved to place our trust, time, and energy into pursuing things that will never totally satisfy that hunger. We're like the Hebrews at the base of Mount Sinai, committing our wealth and collective futures to things we can touch and show off to the neighbors, cars, houses, things that in the end have no lasting value. We convince ourselves that these things make us somehow more lovable or admirable because we possess them. We long for acceptance, satisfaction, purpose, and meaning. And if the sacred doesn't come through for us right now, we comfort ourselves with substitutes, human-made objects or ideas, pursuits or policies that we obsess over and venerate in return for the sense of purpose or meaning that we seek. You know the usual suspects: money, power, influence, fame, respect, security. All of these are vulnerable to being turned into idols, and that's without mentioning golf. And then there's sex. The internet has opened the door to what has become an epidemic of pornography addiction that destroys relationships, promotes human trafficking, and earlier this year even led to a mass shooting in Georgia. Although not limited to Christians, this addiction, this idolatry, seems to be particularly rampant among those who make the loudest condemnations of those caught up by it. Years ago, I used to attend a conference sponsored by the group Youth Specialties. One of the organizers, Mike Iaconelli, commented on a conversation he had with the hotel management. The hotel reported that they love booking Christian groups for conventions, but not because Christians are nice people. It's because the hotel makes more money from pay-per-view porn channels from Christian hotel guests than from any other kind of convention. The bottom line, most anything can be taken to the extreme of idolatry and used as a superficial proxy for our deepest longings for wholeness and meaning. Our guide to promoting Jesus' conspiracy of love, Kurt Struckmeyer, lays out some of the broader concepts that we tend to idolize collectively as a culture. The cult of nationalism. Say it with me. USA, 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 right? The old hack you hear from those who have turned the United States into an idol goes back to an out-of-context Stephen Decatur quote from before the Civil War. Quote, my country, right or wrong. But for those who understand the danger of idolatry, the 1872 comments of Senator Carl Schurz ring more true. Quote, my country, right or wrong, if right, to be kept right, and if wrong, to be set right. Simply put, if you've placed something or someone above reproach, correction, or question, you might be an idolater. If you've placed your race above all other races, then you just might be an idolater. If you've elevated the notion of rugged individualism and the notion of the self-made man or woman over the importance of the broader community, then you just might be an idolater. If you think Your favored economic or political system is the most perfect and unassailable means by which human beings can organize themselves, then you just might be an idolater. And of course, if you think that the solution to the epidemic of mass shootings in this country is to issue every man, woman, and child with an AR-15 with a high-capacity magazine, then you're definitely an idolater. One form of idolatry that never seems to go out of style, though, is to make an idol out of a particular moment in time. For many, mostly white Americans, that time was the 1950s. Any decisions of consequence were made by Protestant white males. Women and people of color knew their places, and there was no such thing as homosexuals. Why don't we just leave it to Beaver? Life was so simple back then, or so the chronically oblivious think. But over and above nationalism, race, rugged individualism, consumerism, the right to bear arms, and a fixation on the good old days, there's one idol that has risen to a place of such unrivaled respect and loyalty that its virtue and superiority has eclipsed all our religions and values combined. It's expressed in our cartoons, comics, video games, and movies. We delight in its potency in sports, foreign policy, economics, militarism, and judging by the popularity of Lao Tzu's Art of War among business people, in our corporatism as well. It's entertaining, it's exhilarating, and for many, it's tied to the very meaning of life. And what is this idol? Violence. Religion revels in violence. Fundamentalists within Christianity, Islam, and Judaism can barely conceal their glee over the anticipated violent fate of those with whom they disagree. According to a Pew study a few years ago, 41% of people in the United States honestly believe that Jesus will return before 2050. And all those non-Christians will get their comeuppance, thrown into the fiery pits of hell to be tortured for eternity by an all-loving and compassionate God. Violence has so infiltrated our culture that even our language is overwhelmed with a continual drumbeat of violence. We shoot people in email. We have a war on poverty, and we fight for peace. Our whole culture, our whole system of government, and our own religion allies us with the idol of violence. We are a wholly compromised culture that is so deeply entangled in the worship of violence that we can't even begin to imagine the existence of any alternatives. We spank children to teach them not to hit one another. As a state, we kill people to convince others it's wrong to kill. Right now, Hamas and Israel are pounding one another again with deadly weapons. Never mind that the vast majority of victims are innocent civilians, many of them children. And why not? Violence always works if we use enough of it, right? We have convinced ourselves that as far as solutions to the world's problems go, violence is our number one choice. Why? Because as Walter Wink writes, violence, be it in actions or words, is the laziest, most exciting, uncomplicated, irrational, primitive, and in the short term, effective course of action the world has ever known. So, what can we do? Well, first off, we can pay more attention to how violence permeates the language we use, the actions we're conditioned to respond with, subtle snubs or exclusion, and the thoughts we've been programmed to think. Then resist our programming. That's how we start to undermine an idol like violence. Think about those folks who made a golden calf for themselves at the foot of Mount Sinai. It was something that was familiar and comfortable. All the other cultures around them had similar idols. It was something they could see and hold and touch that in a shallow, superficial way fulfilled their hunger for something more. And that longing for the more is good. It's good to be hungry for the holy. But the challenge is to not let that hunger degrade into substitutions which are empty idols or short-term fixes like money, influence, security, racial superiority, sexual distraction, or the way things used to be. Those things are all lazy, primitive, and as Wink says, only effective in the short term. But if we've got a genuine longing for something more, for the long term, then we have to be alert to our own golden calves, our own temporary fixes that keep us from living into and embracing the mystery of the divine. Are you an idolater? I know I am. I suspect you are too. The question is, can we engage ourselves so fully in Jesus' conspiracy of love that we can confront the golden calves of our culture and call them out for what they are? If I try to find a definitive teaching from Jesus about idolatry, I'm hard-pressed to point to a single example. But when I look at his encounter with the rich young ruler, I see that the man had made an idol of his wealth and couldn't let go. When I look at Jesus' encounters with the Pharisees, I see that he is challenging their idolatry of purity codes and rituals. The Sadducees idolized the domination system that empowers them. The disciples, those clueless lunkheads, idolized the power they think they'll be coming into as part of Jesus' entourage. And what does Jesus do? He pokes holes in all their efforts. Is wealth worthy of worship? No. Is being the purest, holier-than-thou keeper of the rules? Nah. Will keeping the status quo save you? Will associating with popular religious leaders be your ticket to ride? Nope, nope, and nope. Even though Jesus never came right out quoting Leviticus on not making idols, I think he operated from a basic foundation that is today's stream of thought. Live a non-idolatrous life. Okay. Maybe it's not the best bumper sticker in the world, but I think it can be argued that whatever Jesus meant when he announced the coming of God's conspiracy of love, it was in opposition to all the idols that dominate our lives. As human beings, we are somehow wired to yearn for the more. Call it what you will, an addiction to awe, a hunger for the holy, a longing for something more real than real. If we don't get our fix fast and convenient enough, we're happy to fill that space with graven images, carved pillars, and golden calves. But Leviticus reminds us that the challenge of idolatry should be among our first concerns, awakening us to the reality that, as satisfying as our temporary little fixes might be, that a deeper and more satisfying life of consequence comes only when we set aside the superficial idols and let the mystery of life work its way in us, challenging us, disturbing us, and compelling us to participate in that conspiracy of love that lays the foundation for God's dream for creation. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.